This is the Education Gadfly Show.
Well, look, if you want to fund pre-K, you do it at the state level, and here's how you do it, people. Pot, okay? Pot for pre-K, totes for tykes, okay? Colorado is raking in the money right now with their marijuana legalization. I'm telling you, this is the wave of the future.
I do not support the slogan of Tokes for Tots.
What does Gadfly say?
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. And now, please join me in welcoming my co-host, the Adele Dazeem of the education policy community, Adara Z. Handler.
That's not my name.
I'm sorry, the Adina Menzel?
Close. Better. Better. You know, you laugh, but my name is Dara Z. Handler. How often do you think that that is actually pronounced correctly?
I think that is right. And I have so, look, I feel for John Travolta. And not just because we decided for some reason, my wife and I, to watch Saturday Night Fever the other night again, which is, by the way, an amazing movie.
Agreed.
But I do this sort of thing. I feel like I do this sort of thing all the time, or particularly when, you know, we do a lot of events at Fordham and I'm about to introduce somebody and I have one of those moments of doubt where suddenly I think, oh my God, do I not know how to pronounce their name? Or what if I butcher it? Or anyways, and he's in front of a billion people. So, you know, give the guy a break.
I have learned when it's really important to people, I give them a little phonetically spelled out version of my name.
That helps.
Yeah, it was also the last kid in kindergarten who could spell their own last name. So,
seriously, did that take you all the way to June? Was that what it was?
I'm still working on it.
Thankfully, you were the Z kid also, so you probably didn't get called on until the very end.
I am still working on it.
All right. Well, Dara, there's a lot of things to talk about here on the education reform front. Let's get started. Pamela, let's play Pardon the Gadfly.
Last week, the Ninth Circuit ruled that a high school could punish students who refused to remove clothing bearing the American flag after the school learned of threats of race-related violence during the Cinco de Mayo celebration at the school. Was the ruling right?
Dara. So, you know, we don't do culture war stuff too often here at Fordham, but this one is just too hard to pass up. Okay. So you basically have kids being suspended because they wore to school shirts with the American flag printed on it. Now, the background was the year before at the Cinco de Mayo celebration, there were basically race-based fights. I mean, race riots at this school. And so the school administrator said, you know, we're not going to have any of that this year. And they saw these kids as trying to provoke fights and you know, as being quasi-racist. And so they viewed that they have these rights under the Supreme Court's hearings on free speech in schools to act if somebody wears something that's going to cause a disruption. The Ninth Circuit agreed. A lot of people are going up in arms about this because, again, they're wearing the American flag. How can a school have the right to curtail students' speech by wearing a flag? What's your take on all this?
Well, people would widely agree that schools are allowed to curtail students' rights to wear, say, a bathing suit to school instead of regular clothes, or something with a direct hate message on, you know, a graffiti or something on the shirt, mm-hmm. right? And so I think I hate to say slippery slope, right?
Right.
But, you know, what's the difference between an overtly racist message and something that might incite racism? But it's the same thing. What's, you know, there's nothing inherently sexual about a short skirt,
right?
But you can send a student home for their skirt being too short because of what it implies. So maybe you can send a student home for the American flag.
All right. Well, all right. So let's back up. First of all, sure. Schools can definitely have dress code policies that are about, you know, you cannot be naked when you're at school or showing too much skin. That's one thing, right? But the courts have been clear that it is not okay to engage in, quote, viewpoint discrimination, right? So there's been a lot of debates about this, say, with gay rights stuff. If a kid wears a t-shirt saying, I think gay people, I think homosexuality should be illegal, right? Does a school, a public school as an entity of the government, have a right to say you are not allowed to wear that shirt? What the courts have generally said is, you know, look, you it's not okay to say a pro-gay rights shirt is okay and an anti-gay rights shirt is not okay. So what you've got to do is if this bothers you, you need to then just have a dress code that says everybody has to wear a, you know, plain colored sweater and pants and make sure that it is completely neutral in terms of viewpoint. Same issue here. How can you say that it's okay to wear the Mexican flag on Cinco de Mayo, but not the American flag on Cinco de Mayo? Here's the bigger problem, Dara. We should have never given kids free speech rights in the first place. This was the Tinker decision back in the 60s. This is crazy, in my view, to say that children who are not yet 18, who are not yet sort of full citizens in that way, have free speech rights. Does my six-year-old have free speech rights? I'm a little skeptical.
I agreed with you up until that last point.
Yes, that, I thought you might.
That, you know, uniform... I don't mean uniform in terms of clothing, but yes. Uniform restrictions are better than one-off cases. So instead, it's so much easier to limit than to prohibit. So you say you can only wear plain colored clothing mm-hmm. without, you know, a yes. message on
the
it.
The Supreme Court would allow that.
Right. Then as opposed to making a list of all the stuff that you can't do. Right. But so I think I agree with you up until that point. As far as free speech in school goes, I mean, this... there's a whole bunch of issues here, right? Like, do school newspapers have free speech? And I think there's a difference between something that is produced by a school, public money,
yeah.
and your six-year-old or your 16-year-old going to school, which is their personal choice or mm-hmm. parental choice. I don't know.
Can my six-year-old sue me because I'm keeping him from expressing his point of view on the street? I don't know. I think that starts to be absurd. So that, you know, look, that's, but here's the main thing to know, Dara. The Supreme Court has made a hash of this issue. Okay. You try to make sense of this. Joshua Dunn on Education Next has a great blog post about this. Although not everyone here at Fordham thought it was a great post. I'll be honest with that. But the Supreme Court is so confusing. I do feel for school administrators. It is so unclear what is allowed and what is not allowed in this realm. And that's why you keep having these contradictory court cases. This one is definitely, I think, going to the Supreme Court. Okay.
We can agree on.
Topic number two.
President Obama released his budget report on Tuesday. The showpieces were a $300 million program called Race to the Top for Educational Equity and a Preschool for All initiative. Equity was a major theme. What's the takeaway? And was there anything missing?
Well, the main takeaway is, as we talk about a lot in the Common Core world, you know, there's fiction and there's nonfiction. This budget is fiction, right? Everybody knows it's going nowhere except into campaign ads for the fall election. What's your take on that, Dara?
I mean, I think I would agree that there's little basis in reality here, although I think fiction, or perhaps the right term is wish list. I mean, it's certainly not pulled out of nowhere, but it is a wish list. It is a, you know, something that people going on the campaign trail can hang their hats on and mm-hmm. say, look, I'm advocating for this, whether that actually happens or not.
Yeah. Look, you know, the pre-K thing, I mean, I have sympathy for the administration on this. I do think that well-designed pre-K programs are worth trying to implement. But look, we have this enormous federal investment in Head Start, and everybody agrees that Head Start is not nearly as effective as it could be. And so I also have a lot of sympathy, and this is really where I come down to say, look, it does not make sense to pile a new program on top of Head Start because we're saying, well, it's just impossible to fix Head Start. Come on, we're America. We can fix it. Let's fix it first. Fix Head Start first. That's my platform.
And I think that you and I have discussed before the mess of entanglements you get when you try and take money from something that is completely unrelated and use it to pay for a program.
But you don't think Head Start's unrelated to preschool, do you?
No. But how are they planning, like, raising taxes? Oh, so yeah. the new budget basically does not cut spending at all.
Right.
And it's raising revenue from a lot of unrelated sources and using yep. them to pay yep. for things.
Well, look, if you want to fund pre-K, you do it at the state level. And here's how you do it, people. Pot. Okay, pot for pre-K, tokes for tykes. Okay, Colorado is raking in the money right now with their marijuana legalization. I'm telling you, this is the wave of the future.
I do not support the slogan of tokes for tots.
Well, Dara, that's why you're on the research team and I do the communications work around here.
I'm no good at marketing.
Topic number three.
Louisiana plans to revamp its career and technical education offerings. The plan, called Jumpstart, would see school districts, tier colleges, and private firms establishing regional teams to offer high school juniors and seniors course and workplace training. Is this a good approach?
In a word, yes. I mean, I think that this is the approach that a lot of states are taking, and it's going to work in a lot of places, to have a partnership between schools, between institutions that offer professional degrees, and you match that with workplace needs. And you have, in fact, business associations and employers help develop the curriculum mm-hmm. so that you have an immediate use of what you learn in school. The caveat to this, however, is yeah. that this is going to work in Louisiana, but it's not necessarily going to work in a more rural place like New Mexico.
Well, Louisiana's where got some real rural parts to it, too.
Right. Right. Okay. So,
I mean, have you been watching enough. Duck Dynasty? Hello.
Fair enough. But, you know, I was thinking more about major cities. But no, that's completely fair. That if you have a state that where the opportunity for partnerships with industry are extremely limited,
yeah.
then this plan is not going to work. And so, you know, this the idea of partnerships is almost a national idea. Mm-hmm. But I really press this to be a state driven initiative mm-hmm. just because states are going to realize whether they have the opportunities for partnerships or not. And you don't want to say, well, if you can't have a partnership, then no CTE funding for this state.
No, I agree. And look, John Kasich made a big deal out of vocational education in his State of the State address, which was great. I mean, this is something that's getting a lot of attention and it's long overdue. But a couple questions though here, Dara. First of all, there's always been this concern that employers in America just simply will not pony up the money to do this sort of training because they would rather have somebody else pay for it. You know, they don't want to have to it coming out of their bottom line. And so there's a lot of freeloading. They'd like to have somebody else and then steal the employees that get trained by somebody. How do you deal with that?
You trade. So what you do is you do steal the employees trained by somebody else, but in return, you allow the CTE teachers to participate in the same trainings that you train your workers. Mm. So the factory has its training for its machinists mm-hmm. and for its, you know, the people who design and fix the assembly lines, the its own employees. You send the CTE teachers to those same trainings. Mm-hmm. They bring back that knowledge to their CTE courses, and now you have a trade-off.
And do you think these some of the for-profit career training providers, the ITTs of the world, I mean, are they going to be a part of this in Louisiana or other places? Or is this really more of a community college thing?
It really is going to depend. I mean, it varies state to state. You know, some states with a pretty solid CTE program do have partnerships with the for-profits. Some states don't.
Yeah.
You know, I think you're exactly right that it's going to depend on what the incentives are for participation. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if the for-profits have a really transparent system of where their graduates go on to, then they have more of an incentive to participate.
Yep.
If it's less clear, then they'll just wait for the high schools to turn out students for them.
All right. Very good. You know, this is something that, again, is something I'm thinking a lot about making sure while we work to get more kids, especially low-income kids, into college, including four-year degrees, that we also renew our commitment to career and technical education, which is going to be a great pathway for lots of kids. And you know, we have let it wither on the vine in too many places. It's time to bring back some life to it. Okay. Thank you, Dara. Thank you, Pamela. That's all the time we've got for Pardon the Gadfly. Now it's time for everyone's favorite, Amber's Research Minute. Amber, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Mike.
Amber, what do you think about the slogan, Tokes for Tykes?
Ooh, kind of scary little slogan
or pot
there.
For pre-K. We're trying to think of some funding sources for pre-K, and Colorado has shown us,
ooh,
without raising taxes, you just let people buy marijuana legally, and you get a whole lot of revenue.
All right. To clarify, these are all Mike's ideas.
I think that's dead on arrival, but I could be wrong. You've had some harebrained ideas that have been successful before. So.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate you saying that.
Yeah. But
and just some that have been complete flops, right, actually, but as well. Yeah.
I'm
you win
at,
some, you lose some.
You lose some. Glass half full today.
All right. What you got for us?
We got a new study out called New Evidence on Teacher Labor Supply that examines whether the preferences of teacher applicants, so meaning where they'd like to be placed, is actually shaped by the characteristics of the school and neighborhood. So this is a really neat study. The analysts attended three large job fairs for Chicago public schools in the summer of 2006 and compiled extensive data on where teachers chose to apply and to do initial school interviews with staff on the spot. Mm-hmm. They linked these data with demographic data for the roughly 4,000 applicants who attended the job fairs, as well as information about where they lived in relation to the schools in which they had expressed interest.
Mm-hmm.
Four key findings. Number one, schools with a larger proportion of white or Asian students had more job fair applicants. A 10 percentage point increase in white or Asian students is associated on average with four more applicants per school. Likewise, a 10 percentage point increase in free and reduced lunch students is associated with four fewer applicants per school, per job fair. Number two, African-American candidates are more likely to apply to schools serving African-American populations. Hispanic candidates more likely to apply to schools serving larger populations of limited English proficient students.
Wait, more likely
so in other words,
other teachers or more likely to apply to African-American schools?
African-American schools are more likely to apply to populations with high African-American students.
Okay.
And
then
Hispanic,
are white teachers?
That's right. That's right. And obvious Hispanic, same for Hispanic students going to limited English proficient. Number three, applicants with a degree in math or science appear to value student achievement more. They're more likely to apply to schools with larger proportions of kids meeting basic levels of proficiency than are teachers in other majors. That's kind of interesting, right? And number four, teachers tend to apply to schools close to home. Candidates are 40% less likely to apply to a school that is 3 miles further from their home. Just 3 miles further from their home. Analysts close with several recommendations intended to help lure qualified teachers to disadvantaged areas. This was news to me. CPS has a residency requirement. Am I the only one who didn't know this?
I did not know that.
All CPS employees must live within Chicago city limits.
Interesting.
So they did another little side analysis and found that applicants that live just 5 miles away from CPS, you know, really close to the city limits, mm-hmm. aren't able to be hired. But yet a lot of teachers, apparently not listening to this residency rule, applied anyway and aren't even eligible. So they're losing, you know, potentially a moderately large segment of potential candidates by that silly rule.
That is very interesting. I wonder if that's the case for how many cities that's still
well,
the case
it
for.
Did say in there, you know, New York and Los Angeles, they don't have, you know, in their huge districts, they don't have that.
Right. So, all right, Amber, you started by saying this was an interesting study.
But it proves what we always think we know, right? Like we always say, oh, you know, these and there's mixed evidence, right?
That was my point. It totally tells us what everybody
what
already
knows.
Oh,
right.
You're no kidding.
That's
people don't want to go teach in scary neighborhoods.
But Pamela sent this to me. The first thing I said was, this is unsurprising, but actually it's evidence for what we already know.
All right. Well, you know, it reminds me of a study out of North Carolina. I'm going to forget the guy's name, an economist who looked at what happened when they ended their desegregation program in Charlotte, I think. And all of a sudden, schools became much heavier concentration of either minorities or whites. And, you know, many of the best teachers, white or black, ended up choosing to move towards the whiter schools. So I was interested in that about this question with African-American and Latino teachers. They are more likely than white teachers to go to the minority schools.
Right.
But I wonder if they are still showing a preference
for the white schools. And I had to Google it. Homophily. You guys know that word. Anyway, it means that folks are more likely to aggregate and sort of with their own kind. It's kind of a weird way to say it, but.
Gotcha. Yeah. And so then the question is, of course, what can we do about it? We've seen some federal experiments with bonuses of $20,000 to get people to change schools. Arnie Duncan, Eager Beaver over there, is going to come out with some sort of terrible policy on this soon, telling the nation's 14,000 school districts to move their teachers around.
Yes, got to do
it. It's going to be a complete disaster.
They do that in China, by the way, but anywho.
Oh, yeah. Now, in China, I can imagine it could work because it's a dictatorship.
Yes.
Stare, you've been quiet on this. Did you teach close to your home when you taught in D.C.?
No, I was just thinking about how I got my job in Washington, D.C., which was at a career fair. Mm. And I knew not so much about the different high schools. I knew, you know, the names of the couple good schools and that was it. And my assistant principal, I was standing at the table with two of my friends who were also first year math teachers, and he hired the first three people in line. Barely talked to us. I didn't know anything.
Got a math degree, you're in. Huh?
I knew anything about the demographics of the school. I didn't know where it was.
I was just looking for
a job.
Would you be like one of these teachers who would gravitate to a school with higher proficiency rates if you had the chance? I mean, it seems like these STEM types have more of a choice of where they want to go.
It doesn't surprise me with science. Mm-hmm. So, you know, science taught poorly is really, really, really bad. And when you have students with absolutely no foundational knowledge and you're trying to teach advanced science, it just doesn't work out very well. So the science doesn't actually surprise me that much.
Yeah.
You know, the math, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah. No, I mean, that makes sense, right? I mean, if you want to teach advanced science or math, you want to be in a place where you're going to get to teach advanced science or math. Mm-hmm. Also could be that those people just know how to analyze test scores better than the English and social studies
That's
teachers.
Probably true.
Okay. Well, now that we've made that unsubstantiated generalization, that is all the time we've got for this week. I agree, Amber. It is somewhat interesting.
Yes.
Even if it only confirms everything we already knew.
Yes. Empirical data confirming, you know, common sense.
Yes.
Love it.
I love it. Okay. Amen to the research community. All right, that's all the time we got for this week. Till next week.
I'm Dara Z. Handelar.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at edexcellence.net.